This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 31st of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 64th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This is the good stuff. These are the golden greats, our greatest hits, our best of. Take the radio in your hands and cradle it like a beloved, beautifully put together vinyl box set made for your favourite band's anniversary. Because do you know what this is? This is the best of the cream of the Culture Show's output over the last 12 months. So you might want to sit back, you might want to stand up, I don't know, pour yourself a few fingers of your favourite and enjoy our year in review. The best of our guests.
Terrific.
And we'll celebrate the numerous times we've explored the rest of the world for Radio Gold.
The shaman is also both feminine and masculine. He's both in the world of the death and the world of the living. He's both in the world of the holy sexuality, like this one is covered by dicks everywhere.
Plus, we'll remind you about some of those fantastic Midori House live sessions we've hosted for you here for your listening pleasure.
I just want that. Just want back in your head.
So we've been pretty busy over the last 12 months and we've done all right. There's a lot to get through. So without further delay, I introduce to you the best, the very best of Culture with Robert Bound's 2012, right here on Monocle 24. All right, let us then get the show on the road with our best guests. John Cale, a hero for anyone with ears, stopped by the Culture Show on a trip to London promoting his latest record, Shifty Adventures in Nookie Wood. I felt lucky to be asking the architect of so many incredible things across pop, rock, classical and the less easy to define what floated his boat during the recording of this really majestic new album. John Cale, everyone.
A lot of the other albums, you sit down with a guitar and you get an idea. You sit down with a piano, you get an idea. This one, you sit down with a drum kit and you get an idea. And then you get all involved in your MPC and you use your swing button to excess.
Okay.
And you try and get as much funk into it as you can.
Tell us about your swing button, because some people won't be au fait with that.
Well, there's some argument about my swing button, because if I
use... It sounds like a Nookie Wood anecdote.
That's right. You don't want to play with my swing button.
Not indeed.
You can go to boom and you can use swing and you have it at 40%. You go to somewhere else and the 40% is negotiable. So in a song like Vampire Cafe, for instance, you have a couple of grooves that collide with each other. And when I usually try and put live drums on top of the samples. A lot of drummers that they try to use, and they try to straighten out the groove because it lurches.
So it's all in the swing?
Yes.
That's an unusual place to start a record with a drum kit. As you say, most people start with a guitar. You've often started with a viola. Inform the whole of the rest of the album, the place in which you start?
Yes. I mean, it gets me, my juices going quicker of the song, what the topic is, what the textures are going to be, and et cetera.
Brian Burton, you collaborated on a few of your songs on this new record. People know him as Danger Mouse. Mm-hmm. He's quite a kind of gauzy muddle. He makes kind of...
Man, you have great language. Gauzy.
It's that sort of thing, isn't it? It's kind of like you're listening to it through a kind of like a screen door in an American
true.
House.
A lot of his... I mean, yeah. The history, even, with Danger Doom.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... Yeah, he's an interesting character, and he's very fast, which was impressive.
Is he?
Well, when you're working with computers and artists, you're always like chasing one or the other. He was always like a little step ahead of me. It was great. I mean, we got a lot of work done in about 48 hours.
And that was John Cale putting us into his orbit for a highly enjoyable hour or so here at Midori House as we relive our favourite moments in the year of the Culture Show here on Monocle 24. The word culture, in our particular picture dictionary, has a broad definition. Some of my favourite writers are cooks, so we'll head first to an early morning session in Studio 2 when two of the world's luminaries in recipes stop by. Fergus Henderson, founder of St John and author of the classic Nose to Tail Eating, and Simon Hopkinson, Bibendum's original man behind the pans and author of Roast Chicken and Other Stories, chew the fat and the lean.
I'd always wanted to, when Roast Chicken and Other Stories was written in 1994, I was still cooking at Bibendum in those days, and I started to write the book with the help of my lovely friend Lindsay Barham. But I knew the recipes I wanted to do, how I wanted to get the book across, but I definitely did not want to write a restaurant cookbook. And consequent books since, up to The Good Cook, which came out last year, I've never wanted it to be a chefy book. I've always wanted to write for cooking in the home.
And is that the same for you? Because both of them feel that they belong on a bookshelf in a kitchen rather than an artifact that sort of only belongs in a restaurant kitchen.
I mean, neither of us have done that thing of, you know, an appendix with your veal stock and your chicken stock and your fish stock. And when you get to a recipe, you know, 1 litre of veal stock, see page 203.
No. veal stock doesn't really feature very much in my life.
Nor me. We love veal, but...
And Fergus, how did, after the success of St John itself, the first restaurant, how did you decide to put it down on paper? Because your writing style is... it's very personal, and it seems that there's a lot of heart and soul in the way you write as well.
Sadly, sort of vanity, I think, probably, because you cook and it's eaten, and somehow writing it down, making it a permanent book, I have to use 15 years, and they go, 15 years, this is on the shelf. So there's some sense of permanence.
It is clearly writing. This is what we wanted to talk about on this show, that cookery writing is obviously a form of writing like novel writing is. And to find your voice must be a nice thing when you see it in black typescript on a white piece of paper.
I was very touched when a couple said they read recipes as foreplay. that was quite an achievement. I felt very chuffed that I could help them all.
You were exactly. You were always in their thoughts at every single possible moment. Did they say which recipe it was?
I think I drew a plate curtain over the whole thing. whatever.
And that was Simon Hopkinson and Fergus Henderson shooting the breeze and telling us why their recipes make good foreplay. And from one funny thing to another, here's Rich Fulcher, comedian and comedy writer, and a man who felt that the US elections offered a rich seam of funny to be mined. We invited him here just after the Republican and Democratic conventions to give us his take on the political proceedings.
Eastwood actually took all of the attention away from Romney, so the bar was actually very low. So if Obama were actually worried about something... about, you know, some controversy, he might get, like, Charlie Sheen out right before him to start ranting about Romney losing.
And I think he needs a different prop. He could maybe just shout at a mirror or something, some other piece of household furniture. Yeah. I think he's probably done it before.
A hat rack. I'm sure he's doing it right now.
Charlie, get away from the towel rail.
Charlie!
Barack's coming on.
You're talking to the water in the toilet.
And the Republican convention seemed to, well, Paul Ryan specifically seemed to have a bit of a problem with the truth. What's that?
Well,
is that your abrupt criticism of Paul Ryan?
He did a lot of things wrong. Afterwards, he had an interview where he said he ran the marathon under 3 hours.
I wanted to ask you about this precisely. Yeah.
This is like even a bigger lie, I think, than talking about Medicare, because it's like, you know how fast you ran the marathon. Like, people are going to ask you all the time, hey, you ran a marathon? Yeah. 3 minutes, 14 seconds.
Yeah. I know. It's something you presumably do. How long does it take you, Paul? Three or four hours, something like that. Three or four, I don't know. Or round it down. You don't tend to round it down by an hour.
Yeah, and it's amazing how you don't realize people can fact check these things. He ran like a post 4 hour marathon, which is pretty normal.
Yeah, that's kind of normal, isn't it?
Everybody on the Republican side was talking about, I grew up in a car, or I grew up selling hot dogs in a peanut shell. I grew up in a horse's entrails. You know, it's just really like, show your basic upbringing.
And it's always that thing, it's been said before, that the strength of the Republican Party is that they'll tell you a story, even if it starts with they grew up inside a horse's entrails. They are sort of telling you a story. They're peddling it.
I grew up in a hoove.
That was Rich Fulcher there. And some things just sound good, don't they? This year we love having Peter York and Jim Lee in to talk about their book called Arrested, a best of for Lee's era-defining photographs across fashion, advertising and reportage, aided and abetted by the emollient prose of Peter York. Listen to these guys.
Because I was always sort of verging towards wanting to be a filmmaker, I bought in sort of film lights to my photography much earlier than perhaps I should. I was sort of trying to get myself to go there rather than... So if I felt if I had everything around me, which actually said this was making films, then I was sort of halfway there. So rather than use the flash that other people used, I started bringing my film rights and bringing in crews and getting bigger sets and doing more moving things, which actually, and bigger productions. And by the time I'd ended up in sort of 1978 doing the kind of shoots I was doing, it was sort of the big advertising jobs where there were budgets for there to afford them. And then beyond that, I then moved, you know, to my first commercial as a director in 1978, which was Levi's, which was a jumping into the new quagmire of life, which I'm sorry to say I lived in rather long, far too long.
I get the feeling it was quite a lot of fun.
It was fun. It was well paid. It was great. I brought up 4 children on it, educated them, fed them, and holidayed and had 2 houses and all the awful things you do with money. But, you know, it was a journey.
And Peter, paint a picture of what those shoots were like, maybe, and the lifestyle that surrounded them.
Well, they were extravagant and they were indulgent and they were exactly what you would expect. I mean, people didn't quite have Winnebagos, but they had tremendous egos. And I think what people don't realise is that during the 70s, people were fantastically fastidious, fantastically demanding artistically. And it's only just beginning to be recognised just how important those people were. You know, that whole idea, the decade that taste forgot. The people who were tasteful were excessively tasteful, quite balmily tasteful. You know, that's the founding ground of the sort of senior fashionistas of today. And it was very, very demanding. And they were very demanding. It wasn't the music industry. It wasn't quite the music industry. But nor was it as careerist, as classically careerist as it is now. It was more indulgent then at every level.
Yeah.
And therefore, more fun.
And that was Peter York and Jim Lee. And back in January, producer Katie interviewed one of her heroes, the man, the voice, Ira Glass, host of one of the world's most downloaded podcasts, This American Life. Ira joined Katie all the way from New York for our storytelling special to talk about the craft.
I was not a natural storyteller at all, and it's only by trial and error and making stories that I learned it. And we're very much traditionalists on a show. Like, the stories have a beginning, middle, and an end. And you need something at the beginning that's actually interesting enough and exciting enough and new enough and sort of charming enough. If all else fails, if it's not new enough, at least it has to be like completely winning and funny and something to just pull you in. You definitely need like a great hook for the beginning. And then you need a plot. Like, things have to happen to characters. You on the radio, peculiarly, you also need ideas to accompany the plot. You want the characters in the story to reflect on what has happened to them in an interesting way and in an emotional way. On the radio, it just is much more satisfying.
Is there something about the kind of oral tradition of just one person talking to another person, just hearing another person's voice telling a story, that is really gripping and that has kind of almost transcended technology and time and still remains the most powerful way of telling a story?
I mean, I don't know if it's the most powerful way of telling a story, but there is something very old about hearing somebody tell you something that happened to them, and they're talking from the heart and they're talking with emotion, and the intimacy of that is chemical, you know, like it affects us chemically. And when we're editing the stories, we feel it. When there's tape where somebody's talking that way, every time you hear it, you know, you edit something, you listen to it over and over and over again. And every time you hear it, it still feels like something, like it's just built into what we are. Being able to harness that is really important to making the stories work.
Yeah.
Like, the thing I would say is, like, the intimacy of it is built in. We did a TV show for a couple of years, and it's almost like to get that kind of intimacy, it's like you have to construct an entire scaffolding and an artifice, and you just have to move so many huge blocks of things into place and carefully constructed. Whereas on the radio, like, that's the default position. That's what it's doing when it's not trying to do anything.
That was Ira Glass talking to my producer and radio obsessive Katie Bilboa. And we'll hear more from some of our favourite guests later on in the show. And now for some music. After all that chat, quite recently we played host to Canadian sister act Tegan and Sarah, who came in to do a Midori House session and tell us about their upcoming record, Heartthrob. Here's them shooting the breeze with Tom Hall.
Build a wall of books between us in our bed. Repeat the words that I know we both said. Relax into the knee, we get so comfortable.
like a mole. Just want back in your head. I'm not unfaithful, but I'll...
The last couple of albums we put out, like over the last like 5 years or so, we really focused on cultivating our own headlining show and audience. And right now it's sort of more of a strategic and kind of, I don't know, I guess like a, like it's like working out, like we're like, you know, we're taking these tours with bands that we really admire and love, but also, you know, sometimes doing your own shows, it's sort of like, not that it's easy, but you can kind of like, there's a dynamic way to like approach a set, like play like stuff from our previous records or tell big long stories or whatever. And like when you're out with the Killers and the Black Keys, I mean, you just have to be like, we're playing the hits, hello Aberdeen, you know, like it's very, it's a totally different kind of exercise. And so that's kind of why we decided to do it. It's fun, it's really fun, it's great.
I just want back in your head. I just want back in your head. I'm not unfaithful, but I'll stray. When I get a little scared, when I get a little scared, when I get a little scared.
And that was Tegan and Sarah with an old classic, Back in Your Head. Now, in our celebration of the culture show's golden greats, we're going to take a long look in the mirror at some of the times we went out and about with our mic and our recorder, went and felt the breath straight from the horse's mouth, etc. First of all, I went to Cuba. That was a good one. Watch out for the rum, though. And the dancing. Here's what I think happened there. There was a biennial and lots of sunshine, and we had mojitos and... The Havana Biennale is in its 11th year, although in reality it takes place every time Cuba can stump up the cash to stage it. But like any Biennale, it's the time when a city hitches up its skirts and shows you a bit of leg, and the international art crowd pop the string on their moleskins to write all about it. At the Pabellón Cuba, a beautiful huge concrete roof kept the 34-degree sun off the art. Shh, listen. This, mostly, was wonderful stuff. A wind chime of 1,000 stainless steel spoons, witty videos in dark booths, bubbling cauldrons and airport metal detectors with attitude.
I'm a little bit tired that here in Cuba, because we are a poor country, we are using materials like, you know, recycling and that. And that's not that kind of art. We can make a lot of things, and we are evolutionary. The young artists are like making maybe some evolution in Cuban art. So I'm one of the artists that wants to make a change.
Ah, Cuba, a friend of mine you were. In the summer, I also jumped on the Eurostar to visit Paris's Musée de Quai Branly and the Masters of Chaos show, expertly curated by Jean Deloisy. He was wonderful at describing his show full of shaman and wild totems to sex and cavemen and pagan beauty and God knows what.
And now we are in this transgression world in which we can feel and the necessity of transgressing a bit more the rules of our society, of the convenience. And so you have several artists between the Chapman Brothers and Mike Kelly and Georges Kondo and Tracy Rose, which are all exaggerating. They are doing the grotesque. We are in the grotesque world, which is the last thing which is impossible to stand, in fact. We can stand pornography. We are used to violence. The ultimate frontier, in a way, is the grotesque. And the grotesque is exactly the topic of those full festivals we were speaking of. So now all the laws are broken, and we can see ourselves in the figures that are in front of us, which are composed by all the elements of society, like Archimboldo would have done in a way.
And this is kind of going back. It's a sort of super contemporary piece in many ways, but it harks right back to the first room, back to a shaman. This guy's got a huge erect penis. He's He's got them all over his head. He's kind of. He's also got breasts. He's in the ultimate shaman, demon.
Yeah.
Or he could be you and I don't know.
It's very interesting because you see the shaman is also both feminine and masculine. He's both in the world of the death and the world of the living. He's both in the world of the holy sexuality, like this one is covered by dicks everywhere.
And that was Jean de Loisy in Paris. We've had reports from correspondents all over the world on the show. Back in February, we embarked on a musical tour of Copenhagen with Christian Nyholm from Fake Diamond Records as our guide.
We're heading towards Josephine Phillips, who is the lead singer of the Danish duo called Darkness Falls.
When we started out making our music actually in my apartment just up here. This was the first time we've ever tried to actually sit behind the buttons and trying to produce and create a sound that we really, really like. So we spent a lot of time doing that. And then we had a couple of tracks done. And one day we played it for Trendemüller because he's one of our friends and he just really liked it. And he asked if he could maybe produce or try to produce two tracks in the beginning. And so he did. And then it kind of developed from there.
Now we are sitting in my car heading towards Trendemüller, who Josephine just talked about, who is an artist, I mean a DJ, producer, remixer, everything.
I think a lot of the Scandinavian sound has this melancholic vibe to it. Maybe it's because it's so shitty weather here, also when you are listening to, you know, old Danish folk music for like 300 years ago, and not only Danish but Scandinavian music, it often has this melancholic blue vibe to it, and I think it is just something that is in our blood, and therefore you can find it in nearly every bands that are out now, that they have this kind of melancholic edge to it, I think.
And producer Katie got out too when she heard that experimental composer Stockhausen's Mittwoch aus Licht was being performed in full for the first time in the world, including, yes, a helicopter quartet. She had to go up to the English city of Birmingham to see it for herself.
We're seated back on the stools around the mixing desk. The tension is mounting. Could this all go horribly wrong? Does anyone actually know what's going on? We watch the musicians on individual screens in four corners of the space as the helicopters rise into the air and start moving around, their passengers deep in concentration. None of the four can hear each other, yet technically it's a success. I'm struck by the drama of it, the surprising harmony within the chaos. The relief when it's over. Then it really does get a bit nutty. The show ends with a large camel fighting with and sitting on a trombonist. The camel is unzipped to reveal a man inside who turns out to be a presidential figure, dispatching the surrounding subjects into the universe. It's as if Stockhausen wanted to confuse everyone.
That was Katie reporting there from the world premiere of Stockhausen's Mittwoch aus Licht. And yes, those were real helicopters. On more sober artistic territory, a trip to the world's biggest and best art fair is a midsummer cast iron mark in the cultural calendar. Art Basel, boys and girls.
My name is Adam Scheffer, and I'm a partner at the Chaimon Reed Gallery from New York. Art Basel is always the gold standard, there's no question about it. And we like to think that each of our booths is curated specifically for the audience of each art fair. So one is not necessarily better than each other. This one just tends to be the ones where you bring sort of the most dynamic, the most expensive, the most engaging work. You also have a large amount of space to work with, which is very exciting.
Stephen Friedman of London's Stephen Friedman Gallery is heading for some sort of Basel anniversary.
the great thing about Basel is it mixes the very classical and the contemporary. So you have the very long established galleries downstairs, many of whom have done museum shows. There are often galleries that show work that are absolutely not available for sale, but they rather do a really wonderful presentation of an artist's work because it's really important for the artist's career.
Okay, I'm Luiza Estrina. I have a gallery in São Paulo, Brazil. Everybody's here. Everybody who is interested in art, who collects and who curates, I think from everywhere is here.
Do you think Basel needs to be careful of its kind of reputation, or is it still kind of the solid gold art fair in the middle of the summer for Europe and the rest of the world?
No, I think that all the galleries collect their works during the year to bring to Basel. We save things we don't sell just to bring them here.
And that was some tastes of art Basel there. One of our favourite reports came from Guy Delaunay in Phnom Penh about a new film celebrating the golden age of Cambodian cinema.
The heyday of Cambodian films may have been brief, but while it lasted, it was spectacular. This tiny country produced hundreds of movies in the 1960s and early 70s, the golden years between independence and the genocidal madness of the Khmer Rouge. The decades of war meant almost all the films were lost, but not, it seems, forgotten.
Just the people coming to see the films, Cambodian audience, and they came every day, and kids coming to see a film in the morning, and after they came back in the afternoon, I say, oh, sorry, it's the same film. I say, yeah, we know, but we want to see it again. It was exactly the same behavior 40 years ago when they told me that, yeah, we will see the same film three times a day without no paying the second and the third ticket. So I was so glad to see this behavior restarted again.
The positive reaction prompted Davi to make a film of his own. Golden Slumbers is a documentary about the movies of the 60s and 70s and the people who created them. Davi says the acid test was the reaction of the Cambodian audience when they finally saw his film.
It was incredible because they understood everything because it was a Khmer language, it was also Khmer culture and jokes, so they just applauded all the time, laughed at all the jokes. It was like electric. Ambience and atmosphere, and at the end a lot of emotion because the film ends with emotion sequences, and it was a standing ovation for minutes for the four main characters. So it's the actress Dissavet and the three living filmmakers that we decided to put in the film, who are Lee Boon Yim, his brother Liu Sering, and Mr. Yvon Ham. So four of them were here in front of the audience receiving the standing ovation. It was a lot of emotion.
And that was Guy Delaunay reporting on Cambodian film from Phnom Penh. And finally, a midsummer must-see for the creative classes with one eye on the free bar is the Cannes International Advertising Festival. Culture's producer Katie Bilboa cruised the Croisette.
I'm at the 59th Cannes Lions Festival of Creativity. Once billed as the summer holiday of the advertising world, this year a record 11,000 delegates from the world of creative communications have descended on France's south coast. But it's not all just about applause and backpatting. Nor is it just about the parties, spritzers and long hours in the sun that may have once defined this event. Terry Savage is chair of the festival.
Once upon a time it was more about the parties and the beaches, but in the last 10 years the reality of the awards has always been high, but the inspiration, of course, from seeing great work leaves people on a high, leaves people with aspirations to try and achieve the same. Networking is key, because where else can you go for a week and talk to your peers, exchange ideas, and generally enjoy each other's company, no matter which network or which company you're from?
One of the big shifts this year is the abundance of brands who've chosen to take part. Over 550 have rocked up to the event. Outside the towering convention centre in the blazing sunshine, Colin Nagy from creative agency Barbarian Group explains.
A lot of the brands are here to kind of figure out who's really doing the most interesting stuff, and they're spending a lot of time on the ground meeting with smaller interesting shops. People are kind of like ravenously searching for answers as more like brand dollars are migrating online, and it gets harder to get your message out. So I think finding the most kind of creative ways to do that is really important.
Katie reporting from Cannes there. And we've been inundated with fascinating and colourful reports from all around the world. And we'll be sharing some more of them in a special montage at the end of the show. After this break, it will be time to enjoy some more of our Midori House sessions. Stay tuned.
Revolutions are fertile conditions for filmmakers, so Monocle took a front row seat at the Doha Tribeca Film Festival to witness the cinema of change emerging in the Arab region.
Like anywhere, when there's social change, people want to raise their voices and want to share what they've been through or what they've experienced. And what I like, it's they do it in a very intimate way. And that's what we want to acknowledge as well, because I think it's stronger and smarter on the long run.
Spotlight on celluloid dreams in the Arab world, premiering on Monocle.com.
Now we'll have another track from one of our live shows here. This is Sophie Delilah, a great practitioner of a soulful kind of funk pop and a great guest too. And here she is with What Did I Do?
I remind you of a girl you used to know.
I grew up listening to a lot of soul music and funk because my parents really love that kind of music. So Stevie Wonder obviously has been, you know, my guide for all that type of music.
Yeah, the man with the torch.
Yes, totally.
The Florence Nightingale of your musical career.
Yes.
Stevie would like that, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
Don't understand.
With the full band, like obviously here we did a smaller sort of cozy acoustic set, but with the band there's more technology going on stage.
Tech.
Yes.
Flashing lights?
A little bit, yeah. Okay. But I'm still working on the actual show, so that's to come. But I'm gonna have some surprises.
Oh yeah.
I can't really reveal it yet.
Really?
Yeah, hopefully.
If only we knew, would it be easy to face what we're going through? You wanted me then, but you don't want me now. Not as a friend, and you won't tell me why. I wanna fix it, but I don't know how. Tell me, what did I do to hurt you so?
And that was Sophie Delilah performing What Did I Do for us here at Midori House. It's Culture's Greatest Hits of 2012. Stay tuned. Time to hear some more of our favourite voices who popped up on the show over the last year. And we're back under the moody lighting of the Culture Show's favoured Studio 2. We start with the well-known Australian illustrator Sean Tan, who stopped by our studios when he was in town to speak with Monocle's Adrian Craddock.
I love working actually collaboratively in a group. You know, I've been involved with a few theatre projects and of course the film, and that's great fun, like this, being able to have a conversation, and it actually can speed up the creative process because there's an element of objectivity when you get more than one person discussing. But when it comes to really knocking out creative ideas, I find I have to be almost in a state of extreme tranquility or boredom. So I have the sensitivity to the vague subtleness of most creative ideas, because the good ideas don't hit you like a hammer. They kind of creep almost like a distracting thought at the edge of your other conscious, more intelligent thoughts.
Sure.
And letting it in is sometimes difficult, I find, in a situation where you have to think about other things like people and logistics. It's much like dreaming. You can only sort of dream well when you're quite sedated, and that's how I find is the case when I'm in the studio.
One thing that I find really interesting with your work is it can sometimes be quite dark. I mean, there's this image that always sticks in my mind of that giant fish
mm-hmm.
coming down that urban landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to make a kind of concerted effort to balance the dark with the light? Because, I mean, sometimes you kind of do walk the tightrope of, you know, putting out some work that can be quite almost disturbing in some ways.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yes, I mean, you do, but not for any moral reasons, more for the reasons of realism. Sometimes I do draw something, and it can be either of two things. It can feel too happy, you know, and I don't think life is realistically like that. It's not, life is not by default happy. Neither is it terrible. It's constantly switching and hovering between the two. And so the balance is to do with realism. But you're right, you have to be sort of mindful of it. And that's where the sort of long editorial process comes in, of constantly reflecting on what you've drawn or written and trying to decide which bits work and which bits don't.
That was Sean Tan. And to another one of my heroes next. Jonathan Meads is the world's best exponent of putting ideas on the TV. He's also a street-shrewd interpreter of places, as he calls it in his new book, Museum Without Walls, and places, Meads says, are the world's greatest free shows.
An architect called Peter Alderton, who did rather beautiful jewel-like houses, once said, "What one needs is not more that's exceptional, but a better standard of ordinariness." And it's something I very much believe, that Britain would be hugely improved by volume builders building stuff in the way that they do in Spain and Holland, which I think are currently the leaders in architectural design in Europe. I mean, if one goes across the border from Biarritz, Saint-Jean-de-Luz into Spain, it's like going to a different planet, because, I mean, French building is even more banal than British. But you get into Spain, going to, you know, 20 kilometres down towards San Sebastian, and they're wonderful buildings everywhere. And they're just ordinary buildings, but they're new buildings, but done with a kind of a brio and a kind of inventiveness. And inventiveness and imagination don't cost anything.
But maybe people think it does, because if you have brio and imagination, you're turned into a starchitect, possibly, or you're turned into someone that doesn't do volume building but designs the tallest building or the widest building or a museum for
example.
Yeah,
I mean, starchitects are, I think, really a terrible bore. I mean, they're...
I'd like to point out that Jonathan is making a face while saying the word starchitect.
It is a dreadful word for kind of signature architecture which one finds all over the world now, and these people copy themselves endlessly. They're self-plagiarists to the nth degree. I mean, there's the Calatrava look, and everything Calatrava does is the same. Everything Gehry does is the same. The only real exception to this is Richard Rogers, who is various, but most of them just, you know, they're self-parodists.
That was Jonathan Meads, and we really could have just put out a show of him talking about buildings and driving around and France and what he had for dinner the night before he came into the studio. But in the interest of fairness, we'll move it along, cats. And we'll end this guest selection on food, but this time from the nice table by the window where our favourite restaurant writer is sharpening his pencil and letting us in on a few secrets of how to get a table as good as the one he has and how to get looked after as well as he is. These top tips are from Giles Corran from London's Times. Never now look the loose in the face again when you're enjoying your escalloped Viennois.
When people ask me what's the best restaurant in London or whatever, or the world, I usually will say either the Italian or the gastropub or the Chinese near my house, because anything you can walk home from is marvelous. You don't want to, you know, you don't want to go to a restaurant and not drink because you're driving. You don't want to sit in the back of some stinking minicab, some bloke who doesn't know his way around London hours and hours. In the old days, when the great restaurants were in, when France and Italy sort of and Spain led the way, you know, that's all local. You know, a Spaniard doesn't go for miles and miles. He trawls down the street, popping into different little tapas bars.
Yeah.
And it's getting so you can do that more and more in London. But what I do is I go into my local Italian, and they've just got pizzas, you know, because that's what sells to them. Uh-huh. And what did you have for dinner? Oh, well, we had this. Oh, do you think I can have some of that? Well, you know.
And there's a scheme for this, isn't there? This is about sort of going twice a week then tipping decently,
exactly,
and being friendly and actually treating it not like it's sort of like it's a palace and they're on a pedestal, but they're actually just giving you grub and you're paying for
absolutely
it. There is a transaction.
At that level of restaurant, they are your friends. And in France and Italy, which I no longer consider to be the icons or the beacons, but you go, a waiter and a punter go as equals. The hierarchy doesn't work in the same way. So, yes. And you tip. When you tip, you are not tipping for the service you've had. You're tipping for the service you want to get next time. So, and it doesn't just because your bill's only 30 quid. It doesn't mean you have to give him 10% £3. You can't give a man £3. You know, give the guy a tenner. Give it, it says, there you go, tenner. Hand it, lovely. Don't just leave it and scuttle out. Give the guy a tenner, thanks. It was marvellous. What's your name again? Pedro. Great. So, then go back within a week so he hasn't got time to forget. And
people
then
at home are writing this down.
I should hope they are. Yeah. And then you go, and then you say, oh, Mr. Corran, how, you know, lovely to see you again. Have this particularly nice table. Can I recommend, you know, pout, you're in. And then they will cook beautifully for you. And that's better than going to the Ritz and being sneered at.
Giles Corran there on this, the Best of Culture 2012 on Monocle 24. Time for some more music now. Australia's most excellent folk exponent came to Midori House to wet and dry eyes and tell us how to write a love song too. Here's Angus Stone.
I've been shooting a lot with Super 8 recently.
Okay.
And went to the Redwoods in California and with my love, and I'm really fascinated with film and just the magic and the unknown about it. And there was one moment, I don't know if you know much the Super 8 cameras, but when light comes in and you're shooting up directly at the light, the shutter shuts off because it's too much.
Okay.
And it sort of shuts down and goes black, and then it opens up again when you sort of brush past a leaf or something that sort of blocks the light. And I was in the editing suite looking back at it, and it reminded me when you sort of look up to the canopy without a camera in your eye. You get that sort of shard of broken bright.
That's the best description anyone's ever given for the name of a song or album. We're going to put that, we should just take that one thing out and put it, blast it from the rooftops of Midori House.
We got together and we did our thing. The stormy weather.
That was Angus Stone with Bird on a Buffalo. And there'll be some more music next time from Denmark, right after this break. Stay tuned.
Before you set off on your travels this winter season, don't forget to pick up your issue of Monocle's winter newspaper, Monocle Alpino. We get cold weather combat training from Japan's elite snow patrols. We look at how Iceland has picked itself up and dusted itself off after a nasty wipeout. And we find the comfortable alpine retreats that will have you packing your bags and heading for the hills. Plus, we look at winter warming fashion ideas with all of the trimmings, including Bavarian lederhosen. That's all in the current issue of Monocle Alpino. Prost und zum Wohl!
Welcome back to the last Culture Show of 2012, where we're picking out our best bits of the year for you. Then what? More music. Copenhagen's Gianna Factory made light work of their live session, doing songs from their album Save the Youth. Our guests here at Midori House love these three long-legged, striking, multi-talented female musicians from Denmark and hung around quite a bit at the end of the show. But I can't think why. Here they are with Rainbow Girl.
Monday she feels sad and blue, so she tries to find the same color shoe. Tuesday's fake, so she stays in her bed with a lipstick she paints, a smile big and red. Rainbow girl, rainbow girl.
We kind of just started experimenting with a lot of sounds and a lot of songs and lyrics, and we had this old like factory building in Copenhagen where we just closed the door and the curtains and just like used a lot of time together and just listening to what we just felt like and each other's heartbeats and just get into this kind of synchronic feeling and got inspired by each other, I guess.
And listening to each other's heartbeats, is that a technical musical term or is that far out?
Yeah, it's brand new. Yeah.
It's brand new. So are you going to trademark this? Listen to each other's heartbeats? That sounds like an amazing kind of love song from the 80s.
Yeah, it does.
How might it go?
I can imagine the
How
cover.
Do you think it would go? Be kind of slower, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
be like
maybe.
A ballad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Those are just some ideas.
Yeah, you could join totally on that track. You could be featuring.
She feels down and mellow. The stress shows her chest. It's so fine and it's yellow. Friday, it's a peak of the week. In the mirror, rehearsals of being discreet. Saturday, she's dancing around with grace. Sunday, black mascara's running down her face. Running down her face. Running down her face. Rainbow girl.
That was Gianna Factory performing Rainbow Girl, and this is the Best of Culture from 2012 here on Monocle 24. Welcome back to the last Culture Show of 2012, where we're picking out our best bits of the year for you. And now, rather like a movie that knows it's running out of time and needs to get over a lot of information about the plot in a short amount of time, we present to you, ladies and gentlemen, a montage. Here's what's in it: a sports commentator's special, our really enjoyable and enlightening live shows from London's Frieze Art Fair, our spooky Halloween special, my trip to the increasingly artistic Emirates, a Culture Show comedy special, psychogeographer Ian Sinclair, some highlights from all the music industry events that dear Marcellus has covered for us all over the year, a greenhouse full of old radio shows, something about the world's most infamous drug dealer, and a report on making sandcastles in New York. In your pop.
I'm in a small northern Dutch student town. There's cyclists everywhere, drunk young people pouring out of bars, chips and kebab wrappers on the ground, and 3,000 European music industry representatives running from venue to venue. It's Eurosonic. And it's the 26th year of this festival.
My name is Peter Schmidt. I'm founder and creative director of Eurosonic Noordenslag.
I'm Victor. I'm a drummer of the band Who's the Racket.
Eurosonic is the perfect way to kick off the music year, and everyone is looking forward to a successful and bright 2012.
Okay, so we're in a cemetery. We're in no better place to ask for spirit intervention. Is anyone there? Give me a red for yes. Oh my God, the lights just flick.
Is there anyone with us here? Please say something if you can listen to me, if you can hear me. I'm here to speak with you.
You know all the voices belong to different boats. Just work in direction finder and get the bearings of where they are from you, the people that are among the fish.
A lot of it is really strong region. Even now, like I'm listening and I'm don't always.
You see why they got the voiceover artists in.
Yeah.
We don't depend on the whales so much nowadays, you see. Once we see the whales,
I love reading about how films were made or how films didn't get made, or how an author took 10 years to do this, or how a follow-up album took Guns N' Roses 20 years and $50 million. The interest in the creative process, for me, is something I'll always find fascinating.
And I do remember talking to Patrick Keeler about filming from a train, and he loves the mythology of trains, but he could never accept a shot taken from a train because he hasn't got the control over it. There might be a speck on the window, or there might be a slight shudder, and he has to have complete control, whereas my whole work is about that shudder. It's about the specks on the window. It's about incorporating all
you
of that.
You see the lad work in the meadow, as he tosses the hay without rest, and he yearns for the lengthening shadows as the sun slowly sinks in the west. Then he harks to the thud of a football, and things more important must yield, for nothing must stay in a Kerry man's way when the ball bounces high in the field.
Art is an art when really it expresses the true feelings of the artist. And the artist, whenever he or she is honest, this is the art by itself. Whether we're talking about an artist who has really complex works or simple works, it is the honesty that makes the artist meet with his or her public.
I didn't realize everyone would bring stuff. There's a lot of metal being put into the earth, plywood.
There's this strange tripod here surrounded by some kind of corrugated metal that's just kind of sitting there enigmatically.
You know what this is? This is Elmer's glue and water. If you don't know about this, you don't know nothing about no sandcastles.
There is a lot of people of working class in Colombia who wants to be rich and who wants to change the society, and maybe they see in Pablo Escobar a kind of prototype, maybe.
The best, of course, for a big museum is money, and then second best is probably some artwork, although they're very picky. You'd be surprised what they reject.
It depends how you frame your notes.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got to know someone, perhaps.
So it's all interesting and important. The networking, the new technologies, the free booze, the free food. But what was everyone's favorite band?
Gaga Curries. Yeah. This Japanese two-piece.
I really liked Airbird.
The best new act I've seen so far is Caveman.
Plants and Animals.
Matthew Dear with this live band was pretty awesome.
It's the day after South by Southwest, and the streets are empty, and Austin residents are coming out of their houses again to take back their city. I'm going to take a really long nap and drink some herbal tea to try and recover my voice until next year, when we all go through this again.
We shall close the book now on a massive 2012, where we met some of our heroes, made lots of noise, tried to drink the best sort of wine we could while recording the show, and loved having people in here as much as if it were our own house. But it wasn't. It was Midori House. And despite reputations, we don't often sleep under the mixing desk. We hope you enjoyed it, that you turned your radio up, that you had a wonderful year too, and here's to the next. To toast it and usher it in, a final track from Bahamas, live here on The Culture Show. This is Lost in the Light. Thanks for tuning in.
I'm lost in the lake. I pray for the night. Take me to take you to. After so many words, still nothing's heard. Don't know what we should do. And if someone could see me now, let them see you. Was my greatest thrill when we just stood still. You let me hold your hand till I had my fill. Even counting sheep don't help me sleep. I just toss and turn right there beside you. So if someone could see me now, let them see you. Hard things we've all gotta do. 'Cause this life is long, so you wouldn't be wrong.